short story today. Welcome to Short Story Today, where we celebrate short stories and the authors who write them. My name is John DeSavino, and I'll be your host. On today's episode, we're going to honor the innovative British author Virginia Woolf. She's best known for her novels, Mrs. Dalloway, A Room of One's Own, To the Lighthouse, and Orlando. There are film adaptations of all of those books, some more successful than others. She and her husband, Leonard Woolf, were part of a group of English writers, philosophers, and artists who frequently met between 1907 and 1930, and the group was called the Bloomsbury Group, or Bloomsbury Set. Among its members were some very important writers like Bertrand Russell, Aldous Huxley, T.S. Eliot, E.M. Forster, John Maynard Keynes, and others of their ilk, which made it a very elite group indeed. While Virginia Woolf wrote a number of short stories, they're not really what she's known for, which is what made this a really enjoyable excursion into the archives. She has some remarkable pieces, and you see glimmers of her genius, even though most of these were written very early in her career. The story I'm going to read for you today, called Kew Gardens, has some experimental elements within it, but is generally a pretty accessible piece. It takes place in the park at Kew Gardens on a summer day, and while it has no plot per se, there's a lot of fascinating stuff going on. It is certainly a unique story and quite different from anything I've read thus far. So here it is. Kew Gardens by Virginia Woolf. From the oval-shaped flower bed there rose perhaps 100 stalks spreading into heart-shaped or tongue-shaped leaves halfway up and unfurling at the tip red or blue or yellow petals marked with spots of color raised upon the surface. And from the red, blue, or yellow gloom of the throat emerged a straight bar, rough with gold dust and slightly clubbed at the end. The petals were voluminous enough to be stirred by the summer breeze, and when they moved, the red, blue, and yellow lights passed one over the other, staining an inch of the brown earth beneath with a spot of the most intricate color. The light fell either upon the smooth gray back of a pebble, or the shell of a snail with its brown circular veins, or falling into a raindrop, it expanded with such intensity of red, blue, and yellow the thin walls of water that one expected them to burst and disappear. Instead, the drop was left in a second silver-gray once more, and the light now settled upon the flesh of a leaf, revealing the branching thread of fiber beneath the surface. And again it moved on and spread its illumination in the vast green spaces beneath the dome of the heart-shaped and tongue-shaped leaves. Then the breeze stirred rather more briskly overhead, and the color was flashed into the air above, into the eyes of the men and women who walk in Kew Gardens in July. The figures of these men and women straggled past the flower bed with a curiously irregular movement, not unlike that of the white and blue butterflies who crossed the turf in zigzag flights from bed to bed. The man was about 6 inches in front of the woman, strolling carelessly, while she bore on with greater purpose, only turning her head now and then to see that the children were not too far behind. The man kept this distance in front of the woman purposely, though perhaps unconsciously, for he wished to go on with his thoughts. 15 years ago I came here with Lily, he thought. We sat somewhere over there by a lake, and I begged her to marry me all through the hot afternoon. How the dragonfly kept circling round us. How clearly I see the dragonfly and her shoe with the square silver buckle at the toe. All the time I spoke I saw her shoe, and when it moved impatiently I knew without looking up what she was going to say. The whole of her seemed to be in her shoe, and my love, my desire, were in the dragonfly. For some reason I thought that if it settled there on that leaf, the broad one with the red flower in the middle of it, if the dragonfly settled on the leaf, she would say yes at once, But the dragonfly went round and round. It never settled anywhere. Of course not. Happily not. Or I shouldn't be walking here with Eleanor and the children. Tell me, Eleanor, do you ever think of the past? Why do you ask, Simon? Because I've been thinking of the past. I've been thinking of Lily, the woman I might have married. Well, why are you silent? Do you mind my thinking of the past? Why should I mind, Simon? Doesn't one always think of the past in a garden with men and women lying under the trees? Aren't they one's past? All that remains of it, those men and women, those ghosts lying under the trees, one's happiness, one's reality. For me, a square silver shoe buckle and a dragonfly. For me, a kiss. Imagine 6 little girls sitting before their easels 20 years ago, down by the side of a lake, painting the water lilies, the first red water lilies I'd ever seen. And suddenly a kiss there on the back of my neck. And my hand shook all the afternoon so that I couldn't paint. I took out my watch and marked the hour when I would allow myself to think of the kiss for 5 minutes only. It was so precious. The kiss of an old grey-haired woman with a wart on her nose, the mother of all my kisses, all my life. Come, Caroline, come, Hubert. They walked on past the flower bed, now walking 4 abreast, and soon diminished in size among the trees, and looked half-transparent as the sunlight and shade swam over their backs in large, trembling, irregular patches. In the oval flower-bed, the snail, whose shell had been stained red, blue, and yellow for the space of 2 minutes or so, now appeared to be moving very slightly in its shell, and next began to labor over the crumbs of loose earth which broke away and rolled down as it passed over them. It appeared to have a definite goal in front of it, differing in this respect from the singular high-stepping angular green insect who attempted to cross in front of it, and waited for a second with its antenna trembling as if in deliberation, and then stepped off as rapidly and strangely in the opposite direction. Brown cliffs with deep green lakes in the hollows, flat, blade-like trees that waved from root to tip, round boulders of gray stone, vast, crumpled surfaces of a thin, crackling texture. All these objects lay across the snail's progress between one stalk and another to his goal. Before he had decided whether to circumvent the arched tent of a dead leaf or to breast it, there came past the bed the feet of other human beings. This time they were both men. The younger of the two wore an expression of perhaps unnatural calm. He raised his eyes and fixed them very steadily in front of him, while his companion spoke. And directly his companion had done speaking, he looked on the ground again, and sometimes opened his lips, only after a long pause, and sometimes did not open them at all. The elder man had a curiously uneven and shaky method of walking, jerking his hand forward and throwing up his head abruptly, rather in the manner of an impatient carriage horse, tired of waiting outside a house. But in the man these gestures were irresolute and pointless. He talked almost incessantly. He smiled to himself and again began to talk, as if the smile had been an answer. He was talking about spirits, the spirits of the dead who, according to him, were even now telling him all sorts of odd things about their experiences in heaven.
Heaven was known to the ancients as Thessaly, William, and now with this war the spirit matter is rolling between the hills like thunder.
He paused, seemed to listen, smiled, jerked his head, and continued.
You have a small electric battery and a piece of rubber to insulate the wire. Insulate? Well, we'll skip the details. No good going into details that wouldn't be understood. And in short, the little machine stands in any convenient position by the head of the bed, we will say, on a neat mahogany stand, all arrangements being properly fixed by workmen under my direction. The widow applies her ear and summons the spirit by sign as agreed. Widows. Women in black.
Here he seemed to have caught sight of a woman's dress in the distance, which in the shade looked a purple black. He took off his hat, placed his hand upon his heart, and hurried towards her, muttering and gesticulating feverishly. But William caught him by the sleeve and touched a flower with the tip of his walking stick in order to divert the old man's attention. After looking at it for a moment in some confusion, the old man bent his ear to it and seemed to answer a voice speaking from it, for he began talking about the forests of Uruguay, which he had visited hundreds of years ago in company with the most beautiful young woman in Europe. He could be heard murmuring about forests of Uruguay blanketed with the wax petals of tropical roses, nightingales, sea beaches, mermaids, and women drowned at sea, as he suffered himself to be moved on by William, upon whose face the look of stoical patience grew slowly deeper and deeper. Following his steps so closely as to be slightly puzzled by his gestures, came two elderly women of the lower middle class, one stout and ponderous, the other rosy-cheeked and nimble. Like most people of their station, they were frankly fascinated by any signs of eccentricity betokening a disordered brain, especially in the well-to-do, but they were too far off to be certain whether the gestures were merely eccentric or genuinely mad. After they had scrutinized the old man's back in silence for a moment and given each other a queer, sly look, they went on energetically piecing together their very complicated dialogue.
"Nell, Bert, Lot, says, Phil, Pa, he says, I says, she says, I says, I says, I says. My Bert, Sis, Bill, Grandad, the old man, sugar, sugar, flour, kippers, greens, sugar, sugar, sugar."
The ponderous woman looked through the pattern of falling words at the flowers standing cool, firm, and upright in the earth, with a curious expression. She saw them as a sleeper waking from a heavy sleep sees a brass candlestick reflecting the light in an unfamiliar way, and closes his eyes and opens them, and seeing the brass candlestick again, finally starts broad awake and stares at the candlestick with all his powers. So the heavy woman came to a standstill opposite the oval-shaped flower bed and ceased even to pretend to listen to what the other woman was saying. She stood there letting the words fall over her, swaying the top part of her body slowly backwards and forwards, looking at the flowers. Then she suggested that they should find a seat and have their tea. The snail had now considered every possible method of reaching his goal without going round the dead leaf or climbing over it. Let alone the effort needed for climbing a leaf, he was doubtful whether the thin texture, which vibrated with such an alarming crackle when touched even by the tip of his horns, would bear his weight, and this determined him finally to creep beneath it, for there was a point where the leaf curved high enough from the ground to admit him. He had just inserted his head in the opening and was taking stock of the high brown roof and was getting used to the cool brown light when two other people came past outside on the turf. This time they were both young, a young man and a young woman. They were both in the prime of youth, or even in that season which precedes the prime of youth, the season before the smooth pink folds of the flower have burst their gummy case, when the wings of the butterfly, though fully grown, are motionless in the sun.
"Lucky it isn't Friday," he observed.
"Why? Do you believe in luck?"
"They make you pay sixpence on Friday."
"What's sixpence anyway? Isn't it worth sixpence?"
"What's it? What do you mean by it?"
"Oh, anything. I mean, you know what I mean."
Long pauses came between each of these remarks. They were uttered in toneless and monotonous voices. The couple stood still on the edge of the flower bed, and together pressed the end of her parasol deep down into the soft earth. The action, and the fact that his hand rested on the top of hers, expressed their feelings in a strange way, as these short, insignificant words also expressed something, words with short wings for their heavy body of meaning, inadequate to carry them far, and thus alighting awkwardly upon the very common objects that surrounded them, and were to their inexperienced touch so massive. But who knows, so they thought as they pressed the parasol into the earth, what precipices aren't concealed in them, or what slopes of ice don't shine in the sun on the other side. Who knows? Who has ever seen this before? Even when she wondered what sort of tea they gave you at Kew, He felt that something loomed up behind her words and stood vast and solid behind them, and the mist very slowly rose and uncovered. Oh, heavens, what were those shapes? Little white tables and waitresses who looked first at her and then at him, and there was a bill that he would pay with a real 2-shilling piece, and it was real, all real, he assured himself, fingering the coin in his pocket, real to everyone except to him and to her. Even to him it began to seem real. And then, but it was too exciting to stand and think any longer, and he pulled the parasol out of the earth with a jerk and was impatient to find the place where one had tea with other people, like other people.
Come along, Trissy, it's time we had our tea.
Wherever does one have one's tea?
She asked with the oddest thrill of excitement in her voice, looking vaguely round and letting herself be drawn on down the grass path, trailing her parasol, turning her head this way and that, forgetting her tea, wishing to go down there and then down there, remembering orchids and cranes among wild flowers, a Chinese pagoda and a crimson-crested bird, but he bore her on. Thus one couple after another, with much the same irregular and aimless movement, passed the flower-bed, and were enveloped in layer after layer of green-blue vapor, in which at first their bodies had substance and a dash of color, but later both substance and color dissolved in the green-blue atmosphere. How hot it was! So hot that even the thrush chose to hop like a mechanical bird in the shadow of the flowers, with long pauses between one movement and the next. Instead of rambling vaguely, the white butterflies danced one above another, making with their white shifting flakes the outline of a shattered marble column. Above the tallest flowers, the glass roofs of the palm house shone as if a whole market full of shiny green umbrellas had opened in the sun, and in the drone of the aeroplane, the voice of the summer sky murmured its fierce soul. Yellow and black, pink and snow-white, shapes of all these colors, men, women, and children were spotted for a second upon the horizon. And then, seeing the breadth of yellow that lay upon the grass, they wavered and sought shade beneath the trees, dissolving like drops of water in the yellow and green atmosphere, staining it faintly with red and blue. It seemed as if all gross and heavy bodies had sunk down in the heat, motionless, and lay huddled upon the ground, but their voices went wavering from them as if they were flames lolling from the thick waxen bodies of candles. Voices, yes, voices, wordless voices, breaking the silence suddenly with such depth of contentment, such passion of desire, or in the voices of children, such freshness of surprise,
breaking the silence.
But there was no silence. All the time the motor omnibuses were turning their wheels and changing their gear, like a vast nest of Chinese boxes, all of wrought steel, turning ceaselessly one within another, the city murmured, on the top of which the voices cried aloud, and the petals of myriads of flowers flashed their colors into the air.
When I first read this story, it immediately brought to mind the painting by George Seurat, A Sunday Afternoon on the Island of La Grande Jatte, which famously was the centerpiece of the musical Sunday in the Park with George by Stephen Sondheim and James Lapine. They use a very clever device in the musical of creating a story for each individual Seurat has populated his painting with, and the lyrical quality of Wolfe's writing here creates the effect similarly of a painting come to life. One of the things I love most about this story is the way Wolfe interweaves the natural world with the world created by the human species and parallels the experiences of a snail and what seems like a praying mantis with the experiences of the humans towering over them, who are also encountering barriers, but of a different sort as they make their way through the park. I would say that one of the points she's making with the story is that the natural world has a grace and orderliness that the world of human beings seems to be lacking in. The one big advantage that the natural world has over the human world, as far as being able to maintain such order, is the absence of emotions like love and loneliness and desire, and of course language, which always ends up somehow at odds with emotions. And so those creatures from the natural world become a sort of ironic foil for the humans that inhabit the same space. Virginia Woolf was born Adeline Virginia Stephen on January 25th, 1892, in London. She died on March 28th, 1941. She's considered one of the most important writers of the 20th century, as one of the first contributors, along with authors like James Joyce, to the field of modernist literature, which went against the grain of the traditional style of writing prose, exploring forms like the interior monologue and stream of consciousness. There's a moment in the story I just read where your ears might have pricked up for a minute at the dialogue of the two old women who are walking through the park. When they speak, they are not using standard English. It's fragmentary, and it's clearly experimental in style, and I think, you know, it's fun that Woolf chose to use that in that one instance only. It's a humorous little surprise that she throws in there, either for her own amusement or for ours, but probably both, and it adds a lot to the story. I think this is the perfect place to remind you again about the Get Lit literary podcast created by Stephanie Svars and John Stricker. They have an episode about Virginia Woolf. I believe it is episode 65, and you can access it on their website, www.getlitpodcast.com, or by downloading it from one of the major podcast providers. I have only enough time on my podcast to provide a smattering of information about the authors, but you can get the full story from their podcast, and I think that's an excellent way to round out this podcast experience, especially if you're curious about the author and his or her life and times. And that leads me into the final segment of this week's episode of Short Story Today. I'm going to give you a chance to hear the conclusion of the interview I did last week with Stephanie and John from the Get Lit podcast, where they talk about how they choose the authors for their episodes. So here it is. I'm going to ask a curveball question here. One thing that I've been curious about, I know there's never probably any fear of you running out of people to do podcasts about. I mean, there you could probably do this for, you know, a couple of lifetimes and have subjects to choose from still. But, you know, there's got to be a winnowing process, I would imagine. Sometimes I think about, you know, the popular culture. And I know that you have certainly done popular culture authors and made it clear how important their contributions have been to literature, you know, as a whole. People like, you were just talking about Julia Child, you know, you wouldn't necessarily think of her as someone from the literary world, but she wrote amazing cookbooks that were huge bestsellers and had a huge impact on the popular culture. Now, given that it's the 50th anniversary of The Godfather, okay, let's just take that as an example. Mario Puzo and The Godfather. Now, many people would not think of The Godfather as quote-unquote literature. Yet, the impact that that novel had on the popular culture was massive. So, you know, based on that, and I don't think, I mean, he wrote several books, but he, you know, he wasn't a prolific writer, and that was his magnum opus. So, would someone like him warrant an episode of Get Lit? Do you think he is worthy enough?
That's a really fantastic question, and it's layered in a lot of different ways, and so I'll do my best to sort of synthesize at least what I think is what I'm thinking when I'm choosing an author. But first of all, any kind of literature, anything that gets anybody reading, like Julia Child, is, I think, worthy of having that space. If their contributions to pop culture, get them in there. I don't think John and I are kind of hung up on, are they literature with a capital L authors as ways for us to get them on the podcast. But I also think it's important to acknowledge and recognize that a lot of the authors that we are reporting on are only capital L literature authors to us today, mm-hmm. when at the time a lot of them weren't known, right? Like Herman Melville, no one really read his stuff while he was living, but he's like huge literature with capital L today. So I think it's also a matter of perspective when we're looking at what really constitutes as literature. You know, there's all of these people who've been writing for the last several hundred thousand years, you know, whatever, hundred or thousands of years. And we've been reading their work. So are they not worthy, regardless of if it's The Godfather or Moby Dick or The Great Gatsby? It's if they've got good stories, then we want to tell them.
Mm-hmm. I think that's evidenced by, like Stephanie was saying, the range in the authors that we've chosen from all the way from Hildegard of Bingen to Eric Carle and the Very Hungry Caterpillar.
Yes,
we
have
ranged the gamut.
Charles Schultz, didn't you do a Charles Schultz episode?
Yes.
Yes. Yep. Stephen Sondheim.
The Peanuts.
We had an episode with him as well. And
yes,
like you said, Julia Child. There is so much that the written word has done for humanity. And if we can see a reason to profile someone because of that contribution, we will, regardless of whether or not they typically fit in what people consider the canon.
Right.
Honestly, yeah, John, the only steadfast rule we have is the author must no longer be living. So we only profile deceased authors. So
is that true? I didn't even really make that observation, honestly. Why is that? Just curious.
Yeah, that's a great. So we've made, and I will say we've made two exceptions, and this is just authors that I have known that we've wound up interviewing. And so we do have two episodes out of the 150 something that we have where the author is still alive. But I guess they're done for two reasons. One, they're studied in schools a lot more. So initially we ran through all of the classics. So you'll see Poe, you'll see Fitzgerald, you'll see Salinger, you'll see kind of the ones that wind up in the literary canon of a high school. Mm-hmm. But then it also wound up being that it's a lot easier to find information on authors who are dead. So when I'm going to do my research, I have myriad sources to use. And then if they're more contemporary, I'll often also have interviews or videos that I get to watch. But it's definitely easier to research someone whose kind of body of work, I guess, is completed.
Yes. Yeah, I can imagine.
And there's a definitive biography. That's helpful rather than anything where they're still in the public eye and there might be a certain amount of ambiguity as to some of the stories that have taken place.
Right. You may find an unauthorized biography, but an authorized one might be harder to come by. I think that's a good place to end our conversation today. This has been so much fun. Thank you again, Stephanie and John, for joining me here today and providing really wonderful insight into how the sausage gets made. That's the phrase that I use. I'm stealing from Hamilton.
Great. It's a great phrase. Thank you so much for having us. We love your podcast. We love what you do and
likewise,
the side that you bring to it.
Likewise.
So it's been a pleasure to be here today.
And hopefully we'll have another opportunity down the road to do another one of these crossover episodes. That would be something to look forward to.
Love those guys. So we're going to see about finding another author down the road where we can collaborate again on crossover episodes. I will keep you posted. Well, that's it for today's episode of Short Story Today, where we celebrate short stories and the authors who write them.
You gotta take some time to read a short story today.